My name is Liam Quinn, and I'm going to be talking about the way of XML. What does that mean? I figured that there were a lot of people involved in open source who are coming to XML and saying, what's this thing about? And designing vocabularies and DTDs and schemas and whatever else, and saying, how do I do that? What are the principles behind XML that I should follow that will lead me to success? And so this little talk is designed in two halves. The first half is the principles of XML, principles behind structured markup, really, that are not really XML specific. XML is just one way of doing it. And then the second part is just some more practical tips, because, heck, this is a programming conference. Right? Basic questions. Has anyone here used XML? Wave a sock in the air or something. Right. Has anyone here not used XML? Does anyone here not know what XML is? Or think they, they probably all have different ideas. I don't claim to be authoritative. My job title is XML Activity Lead at the World Wide Web Consortium, and we publish the spec for XML, but I don't actually claim that gives me any authority. It just means that I have a silly job title. Okay. So here's the idea. Take some data, any data, maybe the text of War and Peace, which is a fairly lengthy novel you may have read. And the idea is that data is more valuable when it's labeled and when its constituent parts are labeled. I should have asked, can you actually hear me at the back okay? All right, good. I'm not using the microphone. So this is very easy to understand if you think of the opposite. And I'm going to come back to this again and again. Think of War and Peace with all the chapter headings and paragraph boundaries taken away. So you've just got one continuous stream of words. And I'll make it easier for you. You can have English words and not Russian words, because it was written in Russian. But
Russian.
You speak, okay. Well, in the language of your choice, if I give you the text of War and Peace with all the chapter titles and all the paragraph breaks taken out, how reliably do you think you can put it back together again? And as a special bonus, I'll even give you the paragraphs in the right order. Okay? We won't put it into a SQL database and then do a select and get them back in random order or unspecified order. If I give you a spreadsheet without column headings and I just give you those good old-fashioned comma-separated value files and I say, what are they? Well, who knows? Let's try. Who can tell me? I'm sorry if it's a bit small, but what do the columns mean? Okay, can anyone tell me? Well, okay, this is a ludicrous question. Of course you can't tell me. It could be the money they say. It's obviously a list of people. We recognize words like that as being a list of people. So maybe it's the money they spent on socks last month. Maybe it's the liters of Guinness that they drank last night. I hope not. But if I label the columns, right, you can see. This is pretty basic stuff, but sometimes the really basic stuff is also really important stuff. And the insight here is that these labels help us, they're just informal labels, okay, student and room. And there's nothing formal about this. Some people want to go a step further and invent formal ontologies, as they're called. A lot of people want to do this, and sometimes there's really good reasons for doing it. And I'll come back to that a bit later. I'm sorry for giving you a huge paragraph on the screen. You don't actually. The slides are really for my use rather than anyone else's. The only really important point, though, here is that the version of the table with the labels is much clearer to us as humans than the version without. And yet, the computer doesn't care whether we've got labels or not, as long as we're careful to mark these are labels and these are the things that the labels apply to. Then the computer can quite happily add the numbers up, if that's relevant. I don't know why you'd want to add room numbers up. But if you did, you know, that would be easy. It knows that you don't have to add the word room. Or if it doesn't, you can teach it. The labels, then, are for the humans, not for the computers. Computer would be happiest if we just use numbers for everything. Arguably, I mean, they're pretty good at numbers. They're designed for numbers, at least the way that we design computers, the way that our engineers design computers, is to manipulate numbers. Very occasionally, they have tried to design computers that manipulate strings. The VAX had lots of string manipulation functions in assembly code, which turned out not to work. The computer isn't always right. Has anyone here seen the film Brazil? No, I won't go there. But the idea is that the computer is not always right. Maybe you've played the paranoia role-playing game. You know, the computer is your friend, be happy. The computer tells you to be happy. And we have this cultural idea that the way that we do things is the way that things must be done. And it ain't so. We don't have to use numbers. And one day you're going to need to reverse engineer your data. Has anyone here ever had to reverse engineer a binary file format? 1, 2, 3 people, yeah. And it's quite fun in a way. It's kind of like a cryptographic challenge, right? And you just, whenever I've done it, there's always been the odd bit here and there that I've never quite figured out. And I remember reverse engineering a font format once. And it took me a long time because it turned out there was one particular bit that if the font was bigger than 64 kilobytes and the bit wasn't set and you downloaded the font, you had to reinstall the operating system. But they didn't document that. That was not documented anywhere. And I discovered it by a very expensive trial and error because it took the best part of a day to reload the operating system. So if only the format had been self-describing, if only instead of a little bit there was a string saying reload operating system if present, then boy would that have saved me a lot of time. Okay, so these labels on our data, they're not just for the computer, they're for people as well. Okay. Now we might say we can come up with a single set of labels for all people and all purposes. And in the 1960s, and this went on to the 1970s, and it went on to the 1980s, in fact, the US government was a huge user of typesetting services. And in fact, the US government, by the end of the 1970s, was using 10,000 different companies to typeset its documents. And they would send, at that time, they would send typed manuscripts, and the typesetting companies would retype them. They would rekey them and make them look nice. Great. So the US government said, hang on, we could save a whole lot of money if we just sent you tapes. What format would you like the tapes in? How do we do that? And the typesetting companies wrote back 10,000 letters, because there's 10,000 of them, saying, this is the way in which tapes shall be produced for us. Our format is beginning. Tape format begins like this. You know, byte 1 is this, byte 2 is this, and so on. Or octet, or nonet, or in some cases they were using 9-bit bytes. Because it turned out, I mean, who can tell me how many different formats there were of tapes if you had 10,000 typesetting companies? Yeah, I think I heard the number 10,000, and that is in fact the correct number. Okay, so the US government said, hang on, we're the US government. We're going to tell you what format that you'll accept the tapes from us. And 10,000 typesetting companies said, okay, okay. And then the US government said, okay, what format shall we use? We'll start a committee. So they started a committee. Now, you know where this is going, right? Because what happened is the committee said, we'll gather all of the different kinds of things that are used in all of our documents. And this took rather a long time. In fact, it took about 10 years. And when they'd done, they discovered, hey, it's an open-ended set. We can't possibly predict the total number of labels we will need for paragraphs, lists, tables. It sounds pretty short when you start. It sounds like there's 20 or 30 of them. And then you start doing nuclear submarine repair manuals, and you discover that they've not just got procedures like everyone else. They've got procedures with change bars and point pages. So if you've got a ring binder and you suddenly need to send an update between pages 30 and 31, then you issue page 30A and 30B. And then if you need to update page 30A, you issue page 30A1 and 30A2. It's a piece of paper, because, you know, and so on. And then they discovered that there was stuff they did that had text that was on a slant. And then people were starting to get clever and do text in a circle. And then maybe they needed that, you know. So in the end, they said, what we need to do is mark the data and label the information, and separately over here we'll specify how it's formatted. And so this committee that started in the 1960s published in 1986 the way of labelling the data, and that was SGML, Standard Generalised Markup Language. And then they said we'll start working on the document's semantics language, which became the document style and semantic specification language, DSL, and that was published in 1993 and was not widely adopted. And I'll come back to why. The moral here, though, is not only were there 10,000 typesetting systems, there were 10,000 ways of laying out documents. They're all very slightly different. And if you go back and look at Department of Defense or any large organization's documents, pretty much any government's documents over, say, a 40-year span, you will notice differences. You can, if you get really good at it, you can say, this was done with this model of typewriter, or this was done with this model of typesetter. So this tells us people need to define their own labels. Okay. And you're never going to come up with a fixed set of labels. If we could have a fixed set of labels for all possible meanings, well, okay, that's kind of like saying, if we could have a fixed final version of the dictionary. And that's kind of like saying, if we promise never to invent anything, no one invents anything, stop, no one invents anything. That's not going to work. And even if it did work, we'd still have too many labels for anyone to remember. Okay, now, if you've ever seen Chinese typesetting, then you'll know that they have several thousand ideograms, characters that they use on a daily basis. But every now and again, they need to go to an expert to say, I need the symbol for this. Yes, we've got it in this drawer over here. Here you are. Okay, because they have over 100,000 little buggers. There's too many labels for anyone to remember. And people own their own data. Okay, your data that you write, whether it's a document or a spreadsheet or a configuration file or anything, you own it. It doesn't belong to the community, it doesn't belong to other people, it belongs to you. Right, so to some extent, you have the power to choose labels, but there's constraints on this. Because the value of your data is multiplied, because the word value, that's a subjective word. And value only has meaning in a wider context than one person. You can say, I value this much, but we can't actually have any agreed this muchness unless there's more than one person. It's a social construct. Value is a social construct. And the value of data is multiplied when groups of people share data. Now, in practice in XML, this means that every tool, every time someone comes up with a new XML tool, whether it's an XML editor like Conglomerate or XMetal or whatever, or whether it's a way of printing XML, like XMLROF, the open source XML formatter, every new tool gives us one more way to process XML data. But that means it gives us one more way to process every piece of XML data, because an important rule of XML is that every XML tool can read every XML document. Now, it might not understand the labels, okay, but at a syntactic level, it can read this. Now, this might not sound special to you. Did anyone here ever use a system with 9-bit bytes? Anyone here used a teletype with Bordeaux encoding? Or a system using, how about a system using EBCDIC? Those are still around today. Yeah, there's some nods. Do you know how many variants of EBCDIC you used? Or which variant? No, because, who the hell counts versions of EBCDIC? It's more exciting than counting sheep when you go to sleep. But it turns out there's dozens and dozens of different, slightly different variants. Anyone here used a computer system called Microsoft Windows? No, I don't see anyone. Okay. Well, if you had, you might know that it had this built on this older system called MS-DOS that had multiple code pages, it called them, multiple character sets, which are unlabeled. Okay, and it turns out that when you don't share complete information, you have this horrible interoperability problem. I have used systems with 9-bit bytes. And this is actually why in networking standards, they talk about octets if they mean an 8-bit byte, because not all computers have it. Not all computers consider a byte to be 8 bits. But when you start sharing data that was written in 9 bits, and you start shoving it into 8-bit bytes, you get one of the bits falls off. And it was actually lucky they didn't use it, because they just used it for parity check, so that it was a fit. Okay, so each new tool that we get increases the value of every document it can process, because in XML, every XML processor can process every document. Now, there are some problems with character sets, but they're defined in such a way that if I give you a document in ISO 2022 JP, for example, the Japanese profile of ISO 2022, that's a character set widely used in Japan, and you're using a system that understands Unicode UTF-8, but it doesn't understand this, okay, you can use iConv or any of a number of tools to convert automatically. And the way XML is defined is such that that necessarily works. And that's very important. The document is labeled as to what it started off in, and when we convert reliably. Okay. What that means is that if I create an XML formatter, for example, to format to, I don't know, that dead trees, you know, printed paper, I can now print every XML document that you can possibly create. Now, I might not be able to print it in the way that you had in mind. Maybe you were thinking of a poem with words flowing like trees upwards, and I'm kind of boring and I'm printing it out in straight lines. Or maybe the opposite. Sometimes I like to print documents with words that flow upwards like trees, even if they're nuclear submarine repair manuals, and it drives the nuclear submarine repair people absolutely bonkers, but I get kicks from it. Okay, and I can do this. So when we share sets of labels, what are we doing? We're agreeing to give the same name to more or less the same thing. Now, there's pretty obvious examples here, like paragraph, which we have a tradition going back about 700 years. We have a tradition of about 700 years of marking paragraphs. But what we're doing when we talk about sets of shared labels is we're communicating about communicating. Okay, it's a kind of meta-level thing. I'm saying, I'm going to be telling you about paragraphs. This isn't a paragraph. This is me telling you that I'm going to tell you about paragraphs. And then, this is a paragraph. Now, this isn't information. This is just a way of holding information. Okay, because it's a paragraph. What's in the paragraph is what I'm saying. Okay, so I've got this meta information here, this information about information, which is I'm going to be talking about these labels. This is the set of labels I'm going to be using. And in doing that, we're helping to build communities. We're helping to build groups of people who share common labels, common names for the same things. And we all know at this conference, especially because it's an open source conference, we all know what happens, right, when a group of people get together and share ideas. It doesn't matter how subversive the ideas are. You get a group of people who can build something bigger. But we also know this. People won't share labels unless it's easy. And I promised to come back to this. I mentioned SGML that was published in 1986 and was an ISO standard of about 200 pages that was supposed to tell all those typesetters how to typeset stuff. Well, hey, turned out to be pretty complicated. James Clark, as a pretty skilled programmer, and he's a lot more skilled than I am, I think. And it took him 3 months to read the SGML specification and understand it enough that he could write the first line of code. And this is partly because the spec had poor locality of reference. It might have a footnote on page 197 that completely changes the meaning of chapter 3. All right, so this is it really did do stuff like that. So we took SGML and we made a profile, a simplified profile of it, and called it XML, the extensible markup language. SGML was also extensible, but we needed a different name, so we called it XML. And XML gives you interchange, but it gives you interchange at a communication level. I think of it as being interchange at the brick level, not the building level. Okay, once you've got bricks, people very quickly want to build schools and libraries and prisons and Walmarts and other good or not so good things. And we don't have interchange at the prison and Walmart level. Okay, you can't sort of take a building that's designed to be a Walmart and turn it into prison all the other way around. Or maybe you can, depending on your politics. But and in the same way with XML, a configuration file is not the same as a A-level or 10th grade essay. There's no shared registry. Okay, there's no single group of people saying, this is the set of buildings you can build. Some countries there are, some there aren't. So with XML there isn't. There's no shared registry, and you can invent your own labels. Okay, so the interchange level we've got is you can invent your own labels, but the way in which we share them, that's standardized. Now, when I give you some information, and I put labels in it, I've got some examples here. I've got a sock colour of... My sock colour is forgetfulness. I suppose that actually means something. I did not, in fact, forget to wear socks. But in any case, it's not a colour. And if I say the share price is Sun W, does anyone here recognise that as a ticker symbol? Yeah. All right, that's actually a ticker symbol of a large computer company. There's no prizes for guessing who. But it's not a share price. And if I say... buy forgetful Sun W's furiously, then you look at this and you say, no, wait, this is wrong. This is not what you mean. Right? This is redundancy. Okay, now, we had if anyone was in Alan Kay's keynote, he mentioned the Lisp programming language and parentheses. And one of the problems with, has anyone here ever done Lisp programming? This comes up a lot. People say XML is reinventing Lisp. But in fact, it's not. And there's two main differences. One difference is that we have redundancy in our labels. And that's actually very important. It's important because when you specify a numerical algorithm, you can test it and you can prove whether it's right or not. You give it a set of inputs and a set of outputs, and you run it and see if the inputs give you the outputs. And if they don't, then you say, I'm unhappy, it's wrong. Okay, you can test. And you can also do mathematical proofs, although it can be very difficult. And you can enhance this by associating type information with data as well. But when we start talking about metadata, if I say I'm wearing socks, well, okay, the computer probably can't test that. I mean, I don't have a little webcam under my desk for it to test that. And so if I say my name is Liam Quinn, well, the computer just has to believe me because it doesn't have an independent way of testing that. You can't test that data. And if I say my name is 40 and my age is Liam Quinn, well, the only thing the computer can do is say Liam Quinn is not an integer and age must be expressed in an integer. And I don't like numeric names, but if you really insist, I'll let you have a numeric name because you might. Okay, so when you create a vocabulary, make it obvious. It's really obvious from these names that the values are wrong. If the values are right, on the other hand, and I give you data with values that look plausible, then not only is your confidence in the data increased, but your confidence in the labels is increased too. So, XML then is all about sharing labels. It's a whole lot of brouhaha and fuss about sharing labels. And we have ways of associating type information, commonly called schemas, when we can associate type information with labels. And so the thing that this label applies to must be a number, or it must be match this regular expression, or come from this value set, or whatever. And doing this increases our confidence in those labels. Okay, now I'm going to take these high-level principles and kind of vaguely apply them and give you some lower-level stuff about Earth More Practical. I'm not actually here to try and convince you to use XML. If you have information with structure in it, then I'd like you to go away with the idea that you should consider using XML. In particular, if you have information with structure in it and other people could use that information and could use that structure, then I'd like you to go away with the idea that it's a good idea to use XML in that case. But I'm not interested in dogma. I'm not interested in saying you must use XML everywhere. XML is plain text. If you try to put binary things in it, like audio or images, you've got to convert them to plain text, which will cause efficiency issues, and you've got to say, do I want to do this? On the other hand, the fact that it's plain text means that you can look at someone else's XML and say, how did they do that? We've got this view source principle. And that's very important. Whenever you design an XML vocabulary or any kind of computing system that you want other people to pick up and share and use, think about the view source principle. And this is not just the principle of anyone can read the Nautilus source and recompile it. Okay, because has anyone actually read all of the Nautilus source? I don't just mean anyone here, actually, is it? Has anyone, you know? Because maybe Michael Meeks has, actually, I don't know. Because that's a major undertaking. But you could, for example, look at your desktop file and see how that works. So you can look at a web page and see how that works. Now, if you're creating software to produce web pages or desktop files, go and read the spec, right? Because you've got to produce stuff that other people rely on. But start out by looking at examples. Turns out, XML, like almost all standards, is better if more people can use it. What does that mean? There are some features in XML that I don't particularly like, and I wouldn't have put that. They, you know, kind of got in over my dead body, but then I got resurrected. But that's what had to happen. Because there were groups of people who said, we can't use XML unless it has these features. And in some cases they were right, and actually in other cases they were not right. But it turns out when you're trying to get a standard adopted, if you have a group of people, I mean, we know this from Linux, right? If there's a group of people who say, I'd love to use Linux if only it supported SCSI disks, but it doesn't, so I can't use it. Then what happens is someone goes and writes a SCSI driver, and maybe it's the same person, or maybe it's not. Very often it's not, because if all your disks are SCSI, then you can't get as far as writing a SCSI driver, right? But so you need to have some other system to bootstrap from. So it turns out that the most important thing about a standard is not that it's technically elegant, it's that lots of people can use it. It's what's called interoperability. It's, again, it's that thing where every tool can read every XML file. So your XML data is more useful. Like the spec itself, your data is more useful the more people that can use it. And in order to encourage that, aim for predictability. And what I mean by this is aim for a spec where people can look at it and understand how to do things based on examples. SVG is a good example, the graphics language, because it has shapes that have X and Y positions. And I've used graphics systems that would have a rectangle has a TLX, a TLY for the top left X and Y, and a width and a height, or maybe it has a BRX and a BR, you know, and a pentangle has a, maybe it has a CX and a CY for the center and so on. And it turns out that you need a reference book to use them, because by the time you've got even 20 shapes, you can't remember whether, is it X here or is it Y here? Oh, it doesn't work, I'm getting an error, I'm not getting an error, it's not doing what I, okay? So be consistent. And just like variables in a program, you can have pretty much as many as you need. I mean, okay, there are limits. And I worked for a company once that had to have a C compiler vendor patch their C compiler to allow more than 64,000 external variables. But we had a 16 megabyte C++ source code for a text editor. So you can push the boundaries too far. But you can have as many elements as you need, and no more. Right? But it's you that say how many you need. And if you're interested in the anecdotes, I'll give it to you afterwards. But seeing as we started late, I'll skip it.
You've got lots of time anyway. No skipping the break.
I'm sorry?
No skipping the break, so you've got another half an hour. Anyway.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, it's fun. You can have the anecdote then. Okay. By special request. I had to maintain a program called TROF. Has anyone encountered that? Yeah, a few people. And it has an... I probably shouldn't have said that, actually, because I don't really... You have to remember it was written originally in assembly. And one of the preprocessors for TROF was called EQN, which Brian Kernighan and Linda Cherry wrote. And at the time they wrote it, the particular programming style they used was pretty much state-of-the-art. So... this is not a criticism of what they did, but it's a statement of, we've learned to do better. Okay. Alan Kay, notwithstanding his comments about how all the best programmers were years ago, I don't quite agree with that. But he had a global variable, which was an array, probably a two-dimensional array or something. No, it wasn't. It was a one-dimensional array called EHT, and it stood for equation height. It took me a long time to figure that out, because the program represented mathematical equations internally, and it was going to typeset them, and it needed to know how high they were. Now, what does that mean? Does how high they were mean how high the equation was from the text baseline? Or does it mean how high the equation was, say, from the bottom of an integral sign to the top of an integral sign? It's obvious, right? Any fool would know. Right? I mean, who thinks it's the total height of an equation? Right? And who thinks it's how high from the baseline? And who thinks that if there was a comment in the program explaining which meaning there was, then there will be many fewer bugs in the program? You're right. Because different maintainers have come along to the program and patched it. And they said, I know what equation height means. This is obvious. I'll set this value to be the distance above the baseline. And someone else had said, I know what this means. It's obvious. Now, how high is this? Well, it'll depend on the font we're using. It's this high. Okay. And then when we combine it all together, we get a mess. And it took me a really long time to go through and figure out each use of that array. Because, of course, it was global. It was used throughout the source. It was only a few thousand lines of C. And if the variable instead had been height above baseline, or if there had been two parallel arrays or a structure or something, because this predated object-oriented stuff in widespread use anyway. This was written in the 1970s. So there had been two parallel arrays or something saying height above baseline and vertical size of sub-equation, then a whole host of bugs would never have happened, and programmer months would have been saved. Maybe programmer years, because there were other people doing this as well. I wasn't the only person. There were lots of people taking the EQN source and trying to fix it, not knowing other people were doing it. Just like variable names, choose your element names carefully. Unlike simple variables in C, XML elements all have internal structure, potentially. Okay. And this is quite important, especially if you read books written by relational database guys who tend to take a database field and put a tag around it and say that's an element. And forget about things like HTML paragraphs that have rich text inside them with underlines and hypertext links and images embedded in them. So you should introduce internal structure wherever it's necessary. Right. And again, wherever the purpose of the element is different, wherever the nature of the thing you're labeling is different, give it a different name. Sometimes people want to search your data. Okay, find me all data elements from your CVS changelog. And anyone knows that a date is a small brown fruit. They're kind of wrinkly by the time you get them, usually. And it has a hard stone in the middle. Right? And they come in these little long boxes with forks and you eat them at Christmas. Don't confuse them with figs, because you have too many figs, well, never mind. Or there's another kind of date, which is that I'm going to be meeting at the cinema at 8 p.m. with Clyde. Right? So someone searching through your CVS changelog wants to find entry dates, probably. And it might be that you've got those too, but you've got a mixture. Now, that can be okay if you provide enough context. So a date in a fruit basket is quite different from a date in a log entry, and that's different from a date in romance plans, right? And it's fine to have all of these in the same document if you've got enough context that someone searching can reliably tell them apart. If they can't tell them apart, we're kind of back to that spreadsheet problem where you've got columns of unlabeled data, because if they don't know what the label means, you might as well not have the label there. Although, this is for searching. If I'm reading the database, as we said earlier, the informal labels still do help. So we've still made progress, but we can go further, we can go better. Let's push that boundary. Another way of providing context that you'll come across is using XML namespaces. And the idea there is when you've got completely separate vocabularies, so I'm mixing HTML over here and SVG over here, and potentially they could both have a WPZ element. I'm not going to work out what that stands for because there isn't one. Right, and so I'll say SVG colon WPZ over here and HTML colon WPZ over here. And I can tell them apart. So there is this namespace mechanism in XML, but what matters is that you have context for your labels. Okay, in your XML documents, you're often going to have groups of things. And an easy example is a bulleted list. There's an example of a bulleted list with three items in it. And items in a list like that, they're probably related, and you often want to process them as a group. The obvious thing is you want to print them out, and you want to indent them all the same amount, put little dots in front of them. But if maybe they're repair steps for my nuclear submarine, or for an aircraft. Okay, one of the manuals I worked on was one of those flat flappy things, and it was explaining what to do if the coffee pot won't brew for the ground staff. And you come in and you have preconditions, and you say preconditions is that the person reading this has the following training level, and you know, and the airport will have rules about what union they're in if they can do this task, but we don't put that in the manual, so it's up to the airport. And the guy reads it and says, you need the following, you know, you need coffee beans and a spanner and a piece of sticky tape and banner 3017, part number 3017-9 and a pen. And they get these things together. They go and put the coffee beans in the coffee machine and press the button. And if it works, they can drink coffee and go away and the airplane can fly. If it doesn't work, then they actually have to put a label on it saying does not brew. That they get from the supplied by the airline manufacturer. You sometimes see basically yellow tape. And there's all sorts of huge list of eventualities that might happen in an aircraft and what to do about it. Okay, so this is, again, we've got a group of related items. We've got those preconditions, things you need, who can do the repair, the tests, identifying the item, doing the tests, and what to do depending on the outcome. And you probably want to process each of these individual things as a related unit, and it should have a container, because in XML we're really into nesting. And all of these things are related, and they should all have a container around them, so that I can do things like fetch me all procedures that mention coffee, and I can say search for the keyword coffee, and then work outwards until I get to procedure elements, and fetch me everything between them. Okay. And you can't predict in advance what searches people want to do. But if you label things, this is coffee, this is a procedure, and if you group those sets of labeled things together, these things all apply together, then when someone searches, chances are they're going to fetch meaningful units back out. The converse of this, that you find all too often, is people shoving their own little syntaxes into element content. I've given an example here. This is actually a real example I've seen. Words almost fail me, but they can't because I'm standing here, so I will invent some words. My words are don't do this. You can see there. No, I can't reach up and make a shadow. Oh, I know, I've got a pointy thing. Okay. Woo! Don't do this. Right? Someone has invented syntax here. This is not XML syntax, in case you were wondering. And why couldn't they use angle brackets around the word emphasis and then put the word in and just have an XML element like anyone else? Well, there's no reason. And in fact, if they had done that, they could automatically generate this form if they wanted, if they needed it for some other program. Maybe they're shoving it into a tech macro or something. But they could also do searches, find me all the emphasized stuff. They could use a screen reader. There's screen readers for XML documents that will emphasize text, and they could make use of that. So again, it's all about sharing, building on the work of others. Yeah, it's verbose. Okay. Okay, XML elements are the things that hold our labeled data, have attributes. And that's the other way in which XML is different from Lisp. Mentioned before, one of the ways in which it's different is that instead of just open and close brackets, we have labels that give redundancy. That's very important for checkable data. But the other thing is that instead of just plain lists, we have attributed lists. So you can say things about your data. And a typical Typical attributes are things like an ID, so you can search for it, give this thing an identity. Computer readable, and the X value of a coordinate would be a good example of an attribute, because it's something that the machine understands. Whereas the title of a book is a bad example, because it has structure inside it. And another bad example would be a coordinate with X space Y. Right? Instead, use two attributes, one for X and one for Y. Why? I'll give you an example. A challenge here. You can win my socks if you like. All right. I don't win very much. Has anyone here used XSLT? And written XSLT templates? Okay. XSLT is a way of an XML-based way of manipulating XML to convert XML from one format into another. And it can access element values and attribute values. But you get a whole attribute value back as a string. And then you can process it character by character if you really need to. It's very painful. So I'm going to show you the SVG representation of a graphics path. SVG being an XML-based way of representing graphics. And I'd like you to move the path right by 3 units and down by 0.5 units. Okay, here it is. Right. So path D equals... M means move to, so... Move to location x equals 216, y equals 202. Then draw a line from there to 216 to 186.48. A line from there to here, and so on. Why isn't this a path element with a move to element, and then a line to element, and a line to element, and a line to element, each of which has an x and y attribute? If it was like that, then the XSLT to process it would look like this. And if you're not familiar with XSLT, don't panic. Somewhere. I was wondering if there were lights, but... Right, it's too complicated for me. Can you see that at the back? Yeah, right. This is the first one I've actually cared if you've seen it. All the others I'm just talking about. So this is an XSLT template, and it's saying whenever we get a line to element, we're going to generate a new line two element in our output, and it's going to have two attributes, one called X and one called Y. And the X, for the X attribute, we're going to take the value of the old X attribute and add 3 to it. The value of the old Y attribute. I guess I should have added 0.5 to it there, sorry. And this is the result of doing the talks at midnight in a bar somewhere. But it's slightly inconsistent. I can see a typo as well. You can add the I in. You can add the I in attribute, but luckily the compiler will tell you about that error and you can fix it. Okay. So XML tools tend to deal on XML objects as a whole. Now, of course, there is. I'm not going to show you the way of doing this where you win my socks, because. Not because I don't have any socks, but because if I did, it wouldn't fit on one slide. It would be about 10 slides. Because I would have to write a recursive function to process a character at a time and look for M's and L's and split on. I can split on spaces and then recurse down at each level and generate output. And at alternate levels, I'm going to have to generate X and Y attributes. That's going to be pretty ugly. So don't do that. Okay, if you've got structured data, think first of making it as simple as possible. If it turns out that the representation is too verbose, ask yourself whether gzip solves the problem. If gzip doesn't solve the problem, then maybe consider doing something terser, but don't start out that way. Okay. Labels are all about metadata, so you should feel free to add explicit metadata. This is anything from... In HTML, there was a controversy in about 1994 about whether embedded images should have width and height attributes on them and what to do if they were wrong. And it turned out they made such a difference in speed that they were useful. Sometimes storing a file format is useful, not on the web where we have content types, but it might well be that you need to generate that from some unlabeled data, like you have a raw image file. You can't in fact tell what the size is. you have to store it separately because a raw image file just has bits in it. So sometimes you need metadata. Sometimes you need to keep an audit trail. Okay, and the granularity of that depends on the granularity of editing. So if it's with CVS, then you want to know who made this change and why. And CVS stores that for you. But it might be useful in a content management. Imagine if you're doing computer documentation. Does anyone here do computer documentation? About 120 of you. Okay, great. All right, so I can't count. I'm a computer scientist, we can't count. It's not one of many. Many people do documentation. And you might well want in a chapter of a piece of documentation to say, this is the people who've edited it. Right, like in CVS, you can put $log$ inside the inside an XML comment or an element, and you can get all this information. But you can do better than that. Yeah, I see people grimacing. Sometimes this is useful, particularly if you have a distributed content management system built on top of CVS, if people can't get a CVS. Sometimes if you're editing repair steps in an aircraft, then you really need to know for legal reasons and keep for a minimum of 40 years who edited this paragraph, when, and what change they made for every paragraph. Okay, which person said that if a bit of tile falls off and hits the wing, you don't need to look? Who said that? You know, well, okay, that's one reason, but another reason can be what engineering change meant that when this panel is open and this panel is open, these two contacts must not be pressed. There's an engineering change that happened, and we added a warning. Why did we do that? Because now we want to take that warning away, and we're not sure what the engineering change was. You need to track this stuff. Sometimes you want to do searching or sorting. Okay, so I've got a website of pictures, and I have metadata about the places depicted in the photograph. You can't easily determine that automatically, especially as the photographs are actually taken of buildings that no longer exist in many cases. They're actually not photographs, they're etchings done in the 18th century. And very often the buildings no longer exist, and all we've got is this 18th century picture, and I scanned them, put them on the web. So here's metadata, here's where they came from. You know, this is a picture of this 10th century castle that was bombed in 1675 or some other war. Okay, people want to say find me all castles in Wales or whatever. Sometimes there are legal reasons. I've hinted at a couple. Sometimes you have copyright or license status, like all the GPL comments in source code or ownership data. Sometimes it's just mnemonic. Sometimes I make notes and I record some random fact about where I made the note, like where I was sitting or what I was wearing. Because when I come back to it a year later, remembering where I was when I made the notes sometimes helps me get back the context in which I was thinking and understand the notes better. This is if it's like creative notes for writing or something. Like what colour socks was I wearing? Well, okay, that's not important. Okay. And it's great that people can take my XML data and reuse it in different ways. Okay, people, we have this culture of open source programming, which is that people can take your code and use it in different ways. And sometimes they send you back patches that you weren't expecting, that make your code do something entirely unanticipated, you never dreamed of. Kind of like the people who used to write code for controlling elevators and buildings, discovering that their code was the same algorithm needed for controlling hard disk seek heads. Turns out to be the same problem. You've got a queue of requests, people wanting to go to different floors over here, and over here you've got a queue of requests, people wanting data from different parts of the hard drive, and it's exactly the same problem. And sure enough, so if you open up your hard drive and look inside, you'll see a little numbered button, and there you won't. So some aspects of the solution are different, but the idea is the same. So this means that you want to help people. If people come with unanticipated uses of your XML data, help them. And that means that you should try and anticipate unanticipated uses of your data. How the hell do you do that? It means that if you identify things, like I'm writing a trip report, for example, and I see some places mentioned. Maybe I surround them with an element saying place. And maybe I don't give any more information than that. And someone else coming to my data can go and look those places up and put in coordinates and link them to a map. But I've made it easier for them. Or maybe they simply come back to me and want to do that. Okay. I worked on an encyclopedia of art history once for a CD-ROM, and we did that. It mentioned all the places where a painting was stored, and it would mention gallery names, and we put little gallery name elements in, and city element names in, and painting name elements in. And the programmers were able to take this and let you do things like link it to a map and say, I'm in Prague, what paintings are mentioned in this on this CD-ROM that are in Prague? Okay, what galleries are mentioned? And get a list of all the artists. And, I'm really interested in this artist. Okay, where, you know, now what other artists are mentioned in the same articles as this artist? They're probably in the same school. What other articles are mentioned? And where are they? Are any of those in Prague? And none of this was anticipated by the writers of the encyclopedia, which was actually a printed and, by the way, unillustrated book. Okay. I'm nearly done. Some things, as we've seen earlier, like my sock colour of forgetfulness or whatever it was, can't be tested easily. And this is very common in XML. But other things can, or at least you can test a value space. So you should. And we have three main ways of doing that in XML that are standardised at some level or other. One is that XML originally came with a thing called a DTD, and it would test only structure. Like a chapter has a title and one or more paragraphs in it. And this is pretty useful because it tells you, this thing's got a circle and spokes, doesn't have a chapter. This isn't a chapter, it's a wheel. Take it away. Okay, but sometimes you want to do more than that. You want to say this element has a date in it in this particular format, or this element has got one of these five names in, or it's got four uppercase letters in, the last of which must be a W because it's a NASDAQ symbol for stock symbol. And every little extra bit of checking helps. Right? I mean, who here has written C code? Right? Who here has written C code with the dump core? All right. The rest of you, oh my God, I worship you. But anyway, right. So every little bit of checking, you know, is this pointer null? If the pointer is not null, then we can dereference it. If it is null, then we raise an error and we go back up to our call, or we call an exception or something, or we exit. And so you should test things, okay? Now, W3C XML schemas are quite frightening when you look at them because they have lots of features that were needed to get agreement between some very separate communities. And it's actually turned out to be fabulous that these different communities cooperated. Schemas have more in them than I would like. They have more in them than anyone would like. But that's because no one is in all of these communities at once. And it turns out that there's all these different kind of types that are built in, like date and time types in particular, that are quite complex. But it really is worth using schemas because they do more. They can say, this data's got to match this regular expression, for example. It's pretty powerful. If you test data, remember that someone's going to come up with... I have a friend whose phone number for a long time, well into the 90s, was prickwillow223, or something like that. I don't remember. I'm not going to give you the exact three digits because you'll go and call him if it works or not. But in the UK, that was a working phone number. And he didn't have straight-through dialing. It actually went to his boat on a canal, and you had to call the operator and ask prickwillow223. And that was right into the 1990s. But can you imagine all the forms that said, please enter your 10-digit phone number here, and trying to put prick willow in and getting an error? If anyone's interested, I have an anecdote about how I was unable to buy a plane ticket because someone checked that I had a US zip code. And of course I didn't. And then they were really smart. They checked that my credit card was registered in the same city as my zip code. I didn't have a zip code, so I couldn't possibly do that. So I couldn't buy a plane ticket from them, even though they flew the route I wanted. Okay, don't rewrite your own XML parser. Okay, it's been done before. It's been done pretty well. Build on the work of others. Your text has got to be internationalizable. It was a really big step forward for XML that it's multilingual. You can have XML lang anywhere. And here's my second code snippet. I mentioned before there are book titles mentioning E equals MC squared, which was a great disaster for the people who designed the MARC catalog format, because it doesn't cope with it. So library catalogs talk about E equals MC2, because that's the nearest they can come. And if you're writing, I've used DTD syntax here because it's terse. You can do the same thing with a schema defining your own type, which is to say, if you're defining vocabulary that's got text that's going to present it to a user, you're probably going to want to make it rich. But in your schema or DTD, instead of simply copying everywhere, I mean, this is when you say, it's PC data means text in XML, so you've either got plain text, or we've got a part number, or we've got a SOC color, or we've got a superscript. And a paragraph is any number of those in any order. And I might have 35 elements that are any number of those in any order. Or I can put after the semicolon, I could put a vertical bar and add extra ones in places if I wanted to. If you look at the dot DTD, you'll see it does this to a huge degree. Perhaps too much for anyone to understand it, except Norm is thinking of simplifying it. The important thing here is fields in XML are not just ASCII text. They're not even just UTF-8 Unicode text. They can have markup in them. And your software should be able to deal with that wherever possible. Okay. Similarly, white space matters. I forgot to make this white space blue, but space between elements is sometimes used for indenting or other purposes and doesn't matter. Like space between two paragraphs doesn't matter to the computer. But the space between the words be and careful does matter. Right? Any therapist can tell you that spaces can be really important in the middle of words. Okay. Two more. All right, good. You also have to... There's a few gotchas. I'm not going to go into lots of gotchas. This is one to characterize them. And I guess I'm going to have 5 minutes for questions after, so if there's a kind of thing that is exciting, you can ask. But text entities are little shorthands in XML. And they're kind of old-fashioned. They're kind of going away. I don't mean they're going out of XML. I mean, there's lots of software that doesn't handle them. They get expanded automatically by XML processors and parsers. And then when you save your file, the fact that there was an entity there is lost. Okay, and it's kind of like if you had lots of hash defines in your C program, and then you brought your C program into Emacs or VI, and it expanded all the hash defines for you. And suddenly you just had all the constants in your program. That would be a disaster. Because the whole point of them is so that you can change, well, you don't change the value of pi, but you've got the information in your program that you're using pi, that this number is pi. More likely, you've got I once had to maintain a program that had hash define O-N-E space 2 at the start. Right? Well, at least I didn't have to go through and look for every 2 and change it to a 7. But I don't now remember why it was 1. Okay, but so in XML, use an element if you want to refer to reusable components, and the fact that the element was there will survive. In order to do that, wherever you want to be able to reuse things, you've got to allow elements. And that goes back to the previous slide about allowing structure everywhere. But then you can follow links. You can say, this guy here is using a copy of this guy here. You can do that with XSLT, with XML query, with the DOM, with all these tools, with the editor. Click on here and go back there. Okay, so XML is this format for structured information. And it's all about explicit representation of information. It's about relationships. Like bricks, it's powerful enough to do other things with. Okay, and you get a lot of benefits if you spend a little extra time thinking about how you use this stuff. So, okay, I don't know if that's useful or not, but there we are, stopped. Does anyone have any questions? Yeah?
In the background of your presentation, you mentioned that you thought Microsoft Office 2003 was further ahead of some of the stuff that we're doing.
Yeah, I did.
I was kind of interested in hearing that.
And in fact, what they've done is they've banged a little bit and given us a bit more time. In Word 11, which I think they are marketing as Word 2003. I just saw that. I saw an early beta. In fact, I saw a pre-announced beta. They did this wonderful conference call with W3C. I was just a nerd about it. I was so excited. That's kind of cool. And the cool thing was that they were excited about structured data and XML that they'd been corporately ignoring for a long time, but internally had been using for many years. And Word 11 lets you define your own schemas, your own vocabularies, and map your own elements into styles. So you could use Word 11 to edit docbook files, for example, natively. Okay, can handle nesting and could handle schema-based validation and SSLT going on in real time. The only thing it couldn't do is you can't reorder data. But whereas OpenOffice has gone down this road of defining a single vocabulary for all Office documents, okay, and that vocabulary is based on the feature set in OpenOffice at the moment. Right? If we suddenly add text that grows upwards like trees, they're going to need a new tag. Whereas in Microsoft Office 11, you can invent your own tags. They're already there. And then your question is, well, you need new style stuff to map that, but your data doesn't need to be changed. Right, so that in their way of thinking about XML, I think they're a long way ahead of the OpenOffice stuff and anything else I'm seeing going on. And I think we have to watch out that we're not caught out by that. That we actually remember this thing that the user owns the data, and that means the user owns the labels in the data as well.
So it's more like the user thinks it's possible.
There's an XML problem because you really want people to have the information in the labels. I don't just want to have spiral in the label, I want to have poem. Right? And I can do that with one product and not the other, and guess which one I want to use. Right. Okay. Yeah.
About dictionaries. You are talking that the more people use dictionaries, the better for everyone and for everyone around them. So when someone creates thinks about which dictionary to use, and then it looks on the web and finds some standard dictionary. But this dictionary is excessive, very complex, and much, much larger than necessary for the project. So people are trying to use standard dictionary, which is very big and very complex, or invent their own tiny comic just for this kind of project. What would be your recommendation?
The use of the word dictionary there, I think, is a difficult one. I'm not really sure what you mean. I think we should maybe talk afterwards about that. But I think, I'm not sure I understand the question.
To use standard dictionary, even if it's much larger than it's necessary, even if it's Oracle, also invent own dictionary.
Sometimes it's better to use what's out there already and better to build on what's there. And sometimes what you can do is you can make a profile. You say, we'll use a subset. And I should stop because I think someone else is about to speak in here. I've no idea who. Is it you?
Yeah.
Okay. But thank you. Thank you for coming.